Willkommen, bienvenue, and welcome to the Bitcoin Infinity Academy. This is our course on my second book, Bitcoin Independence Reimagined, and we are looking forward to a chapter today called Mainstream Mediocrity. I'm Knut Svanholm, and I'm here as always with Luke DeWolf. Good morning, Luke. How are you today?
Good morning, Knut. Doing great and excited for this one. Yeah, as you say, mainstream mediocrity. I'm excited to dig into that and find out what it's all about.
Some middle of the bell curve stuff, I guess.
I suppose so. All right, before we dive into that, the best way you can support the show and get involved with the Academy is to go to our Geyser page at geyser.fund/project/infinity and find out all the details about how you can get involved. You can join the live recordings and join our discussion groups, and there's a whole bunch of other things. You can join just one course or you can join the entire bundle all at once. It's up to you. So just go check us out there at geyser.fund/project/infinity. And now let's dive into mainstream mediocrity. What is a medium of exchange? A monetary good is often described as a store of value, a medium of exchange, and a unit of account. But what do these descriptions actually mean? And in what order are they important for a monetary good to succeed, in the short and the long term? It all depends on the depth of one's analysis. Let's rewind to the dawn of civilized society. Money hasn't really been invented yet, and good old bartering is the only means of trading there is. I will give you my 3 goats if you give me your cow. If the receiver of this proposal values 3 goats more than 1 cow, an exchange occurs. This is at the very core of all human interaction that isn't violent. Both parties believe that they stand to gain something from the interaction. If this wasn't the case, no interaction would have taken place. But how can I know that one or more of my 3 goats won't be used as barter in another exchange in which I'm not a participant? I can't, and neither can anyone else except the new owner of these bearded omnivores. They are, by definition, a medium of exchange. So is everything else. Every physical thing that anyone has ever claimed ownership of can be used as a medium of exchange. That good's usefulness, as such, however, is another matter. All right, I'll pause here for all the comments about medium of exchange and et cetera.
Yeah, I won't go into any deeper detail on that right now, I think. But yeah, good to point out that money solves 2 problems. One is the mutual coincidence of needs. So if I have money, I don't need to necessarily have exactly 3 goats to make the exchange. I have something abstract that I can exchange instead of exchanging the bartered goods. The other one is economic calculation, which is not possible with cows and goats, because if you're shifting the unit all the time, and as we know, valuations are subjective and dynamic, so it's very hard to perform any type of economic calculation or assessment if you're dealing in bartered goods, which is why no barter civilization has ever happened. Like, civilizations form when money is a thing. Before money, societies are very, very crude and basic. We can't really get anywhere without a common medium of exchange.
Absolutely. And the other point that I'll double click on here is just that everyone, both sides of an exchange, have to think it's beneficial to them, or else it doesn't happen, or else it's coerced. And I think that's just extremely important here. Every exchange is a win-win, or at least if it's not seen as a win-win by someone, let me actually kind of play this out slightly. Like, if someone is doing something out of, say, desperation or whatever at their circumstance, and maybe they don't actually want to do the thing if they could have avoided it, they don't want to, I don't know, sell their prized guitar to the pawn shop because they need the $50 in order so that they don't starve, they're still getting something for the good to satisfy another need. And it just trickles down. Somewhere there's a benefit to them, and the exchange works and makes sense. So,
yeah.
Right?
I can add a couple of things to that. I mean, human action doesn't take into account your personal feelings towards anything or how desperate you are. And also, this applies to non-consensual transactions as well. They're still voluntary. It's just that they're not consensual. So they're voluntary in the sense that if I put a gun at your head and say, give me your money or your life, your life is probably worth more to you than your money. So you're voluntarily giving up your money to keep on living. So that is also a perceived value. Like you perceive it to be more valuable to you to give up the money if the robber points a gun at your head, because you value your life more. So all action and all human interactions follow the same principles. It's just that it's a winner take all scenario when aggression is involved. When aggression is not involved, then both parties perceive to win something from the exchange, and that's the crucial difference. It's not a zero sum game. It's everyone wins. But as soon as there's any violent interaction, whether it be taxes, inflation, or any type of government intervention, anything that is not entirely consensual, then the preferences are slightly different. You're making the choice with the threat in mind. You're making the choice like, I'm going to buy this water bottle even though it has VAT because I value my thirst, but I might not buy it because it's at a higher price. So I might refrain from doing the thing because the VAT is there. So it's influenced by an aggressor. Do you follow me here? Look, like I'm struggling to find the words, but the interventionism always leads away from the both parties benefit aspect of a transaction.
It makes the win-win potentially worse. It could still be that the win-win is there, but it's very likely that it's muted or less good than it could have been, because the government is always taking some kind of cut.
Yeah. It's sort of, you can still hear the trumpet even though the dampener is on it. Like, bad analogy, but still.
Yes, I think we should move on and continue the discussion. A goat can hardly be considered a very effective form of value-bearing asset by anyone. In order for a good to be a useful medium of exchange, it not only needs to be portable, divisible, fungible, and not easily confiscatable, but it also needs to be able to store value, at least in the short term. Storing value is the trickiest part, since what anyone finds valuable is entirely subjective. This is easily forgotten. The order in which the other monetary properties are important depends on how, where, why, and when the supposed exchange takes place. A car, for instance, can be considered relatively portable if it works and the potential buyer is within an acceptable driving range, but it's not very divisible and quite easy to confiscate. In-game gold or Monopoly money, on the other hand, is very divisible and portable, but not very fungible, since it's almost exclusively attractive to those playing a very specific game at a very specific point in time. Not only this, but in-game gold can be infinitely mined, and Monopoly money can easily be printed. The rules of Monopoly even say to just write numbers on a piece of paper when the bank runs out of bills. These examples might seem arbitrary and insignificant to any real-world economy, but the truth is that the only thing separating money from other goods as a medium of exchange is money's usefulness as such. And yes, I think that's extremely important, and emphasizing the properties of money and Bitcoin's role as money is very important.
Yeah, this exclusively attractive to those playing a very specific game. This is sort of the biggest hurdle to Bitcoin adoption at the time, because not everyone is playing the Bitcoin game at this moment in time. Eventually, everyone will, but we need to onboard new players before they are willing to accept Bitcoin. And there are plenty of ways to do that. You can give them a generous tip if they choose to accept Bitcoin, and all sorts of other things. Like, you can just orange pill them and onboard them and tell them about the benefits of the thing. And chances are high that sooner or later they will hop onto this game. Also, the Lindy effect plays in. Like, the longer Bitcoin exists and people see that it works and that it delivers on its promises, the more likely people are to play this specific game. But I like the game analogy, because it sort of alludes to this being an actual network, and Metcalfe's law comes into play. The value of a communications network is equal to its number of users squared, which is just one aspect of why number go up will turn into number go absolutely bonkers at one time. The other one is, of course, the scarcity and the store of value thing here. I've lately I've promoted medium exchange over time as a substitute term for store of value. Doesn't really matter what term you use. Like the point is that it's keeping its promises over long spans of time, and the, how crucial that is for money to actually function in an optimal way.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things here about Bitcoin, and maybe we don't talk about it often enough, is that it really is the sum of all of the things that makes Bitcoin the valuable thing that it is. It needs to have the network effect. It needs to be good at the properties of medium of exchange. It needs to do things it needs to have the scarcity properties, which is basically what enables the store of value or medium of exchange over time. It needs to have all of this. And the whole thing with it is that the technological capabilities of Bitcoin are really what give it its value proposition. But it's the users and the network effect of the users that also means that it's got a shot at being the best money the world has ever seen. It's got all of the potential to do it, and the longer it goes, the more likely it is that it's going to work. So I'm excited.
Yeah, and you can compare it to other things than just fiat and gold. You can compare it to the Mona Lisa, for instance, of which there is one, so it's extremely scarce. It's also very recognizable. It's recognized by almost everyone on Earth. If you know about one painting, it's probably the Mona Lisa. So it's insanely valuable, even though it's not divisible, and it's very confiscatable. It's not very portable. Still, it has an almost infinite value because it's the most famous painting in the world. And yeah, if Bitcoin just had that, if Bitcoin was the most famous type of money in the world, then even that would make it almost infinitely valuable, just the scarcity and being famous. But Bitcoin is so much more than that. It is divisible. And you can divide it into sub-satoshis over the Lightning Network and stuff. It's also extremely portable since it's just information. You can walk across a border with the Bitcoins in your head and all of this stuff. So it has all these other properties to it that make it valuable, except the scarcity and the recognizability. But just to point out that those two would be enough if it got popular enough. So it's just insane how the potential of this thing.
Love it. Let's continue the discussion. In order for anyone to accept something as payment for another thing, they need to be confident that this something will not lose its value anytime soon. This is the one key property that any method of payment must hold. The greatest threat to this property is said medium's potential to be produced in large quantities over a short span of time. An apple can be bought for a certain amount of money. But no one would accept apples as payment for a new car, since the apples would rot and lose their value well before they could exchange them for something else. What everyone seems to have forgotten is that the same is true for fiat money. Your dollars or euros won't rot overnight, but they will rot over a couple of decades. No one stacks cash in their mattresses anymore for this reason. Inflation deprives us of the ability to store the value of our labor long term. Because of this, every decision made by every politician, every merchant, and every entrepreneur today is influenced by an unconscious incentive to focus on increasingly shorter-term benefits. Human progress is equipped with a damper, and we're not as progressive, effective, or innovative as we could have been. All because of our overlord's inability to resist the urge to dilute our money supply. The temptation to counterfeit has existed for as long as money has existed. And no civilization has ever been able to stop it. On the contrary, we've been very inventive in coming up with plausible excuses for printing money. The latest term for this criminal behavior is quantitative easing. Yes, so some properties about not losing value, which Bitcoin is very good at.
Yeah, and also like hinting at this damper and how we don't know what the future would have been if we didn't have this damper, and how much better, exponentially better the future could have been. And also why we need Bitcoin, because no civilization has ever been able to resist the temptation of meddling with the money supply. And if that is because evil people end up on top, or because you become evil when you equipped with a money printer, can be debated. In a perfect world, we wouldn't need Bitcoin because all we would need is a spreadsheet. The only reason we need the time chain and all this insane security is the don't trust verify. Like, we want to remove the trust from the equation. We want to have rules without rulers, because history has shown that we can't have rules with rulers, because the rulers will be corrupted over time. So yeah, and just to explain quantitative easing, I don't think I go into this any deeper in this chapter. Quantitative easing is basically, yeah, the US version of it is when the Fed prints a bunch of money, gives it to the government in return for government bonds. And what is a government bond? A government bond is a promise from the government to make more money in the future. How does the government make money? Well, it takes it from its citizens, its subjects. So it's a promise to steal even more from you and your children in the future. And in return for that, they get to dilute the value of your money. So it's truly evil and on every level. And it hurts the little guy the most. It hurts the poor classes much more than it hurts the elite. They have assets, and therefore they win from money printing. Cantillon effect all over again.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't want to sound all commie or whatever when I make arguments and you make arguments and I agree with them that this hurts the poor the most. It's just an observation. And all of these people who are on the left who seem to think that they're all for the poor and the downtrodden and the working class and all this, they should be the ones picking up on this, because this is the way to go about it. It's just that it's counterintuitive to them that taking away power from the money printers and the tax authorities who put in VAT and things like this is actually going to help the people at the bottom, not hurt them. I care about individuals as individuals, and however you identify in terms of your monetary ability, I identify as a billionaire, therefore it's all fine. However you identify, I attempted a joke there. If you identify as a person without means, or a person of home, a person without home or something like that. Okay, this just isn't going anywhere. I'm gonna move on.
You can identify as a SATS billionaire, maybe.
That's right. Something like that. The whole thing is that it's individuals get more power and are able to do more for themselves, which improves things if we don't have the money printer in the way. The only other specific point I wanted to latch onto here is that the ability to know that a medium of exchange or won't lose its value over time. The argument that's usually made against that for Bitcoin is its volatility. Like, it goes up and down. So how do you know that your Bitcoin is going to be worth as much, you know, in a week or a month or something like that? Maybe it's going to go down. But the thing that gets forgotten is that we're all talking about in fiat terms. You still have your sats. That's not going away. The sats themselves haven't rotted away. What one individual is willing to trade another individual for those sats can change. But, just look at the chart. Look at the four-year average. It's always going up forever, Laura. So the thing is, as long as you can have your sats and rely on having those sats, sure, maybe you need to pay your bills, and maybe it's better to take advantage of use the Bitcoin that you get on the things you need to pay the bills for when you get them, and get yourself out of that volatility. But whatever you can afford to wait for a few years for before spending, that's going to be worth so much more over time.
The easiest way to hedge against volatility is, of course, to accept Bitcoin for goods and services. Then you will cheer when Bitcoin drops in price, because you get more sats for your goods and services per unit sold. So that's obviously the way to not only hedge against it, but also flatten out the curve. The more people that do this, the more easy it will be to denominate in Bitcoin and not the less volatile it will become over time. This is how we fix this. And if you say, like, no, but I'm not able to pay my bills in Bitcoin. Well, be the guy that bills people in Bitcoin then. Obviously, like, this is not, it doesn't start with you spending the Bitcoin. It starts with you accepting the Bitcoin. And to me, this is obvious, and it's very hard to see why people can't seem to grasp that.
Definitely. I think we should continue and go a little more into the properties of Bitcoin. Enter Bitcoin, a monetary entity that no human can alter or even influence at this point in time. A very divisible token directly linked to the most fundamental thing of value the universe has to offer, energy. A means of converting energy into a part of the world's only digital pie, of which no more than 21 million slices can ever be cut. A portable, divisible, fungible, and not easily confiscatable form of money that exists and proves its superiority to the existing system every day. So why isn't Bitcoin particularly popular as a medium of exchange? Will it ever be? And more importantly, does it really matter? To answer this, we must dive a little deeper into the subject. Bitcoin is a very good store of value from a personal perspective. You acquire an amount, and that amount stays the same over time. More importantly, that amount will represent the same part of the total sum of Bitcoin that can ever exist, no matter how long you choose to keep it. If you want a specific amount of Bitcoin to buy you a Lambo, all you have to do is wait for someone to be willing to sell you a Lambo for that amount. This might take a while, or it might not, but if Bitcoin just manages to keep on doing what it does, it will happen. It is only a matter of time because, unlike Lambos, Bitcoins are scarce, very scarce, even absolutely scarce, which is a property of an asset that mankind has never encountered before. More and more people realize this every day, which is why they're reluctant to sell their Bitcoin. The newly minted Bitcoin that is mined every day needs to be sold in order for the miners' business models to work, but the Bitcoin that is already in circulation tends to stay where it is because people value the coins they possess a lot higher than what the current price in dollars or euros happens to be. Okay, a lot here about Bitcoin and its properties.
Yeah, I'd say you often hear that Bitcoin needs to be a medium of exchange to function. Like Jack Dorsey has been saying that, Jeff Booth has been saying that. I mean, we say that too, and we like love promoting Bitcoin usage in the sense that we need to use it as a medium of exchange over space. But I'd say, who's to say how long you should hold on to your Bitcoin before you spend them? There's like no good way of quantifying this. And we live in a world where we think that the Keynesian fallacy in saying that all transactions matter equally, that is simply not true. Like there's no objective way of measuring that the value of transactions themselves. Sure, you need to transact at some point. Bitcoin needs to be money, but what that looks like in a system that no one has ever seen before, is very hard to imagine. It probably doesn't mean you use Bitcoin every day to buy fucking eggs. You'd probably use something else, or at least a layer two. Maybe you have a subscription to eggs that you pay once per year, and then you get all the eggs you need that year. Like, I think these subscription models and like fewer transactions type of monetary behavior will be much more common on a Bitcoin standard. Instead of putting a coin in a slot at the washroom in the central station of European City X, you will buy a subscription to all the train rides and all the washrooms you could ever need in central stations, a one-time payment, and you have a sort of a subscription service. I think the economy is going towards that on a Bitcoin standard because transactions are expensive. In the fiat world, the cost of the transaction is always hidden, but you need to pay banks and credit card providers and central banks and so forth all the time. It's just that we don't see the costs. And Bitcoin is much easier to see the cost because you can see how much fee you paid to miners. So I suspect we're going to a world, if you extrapolate this thought vector, we're going into a world with fewer transactions in general, and that's a good thing. It doesn't mean that I'm against Bitcoin as a medium of exchange. I just think that this looks completely different on a Bitcoin standard than on a fiat standard.
Absolutely. Well, and I think the thing is, maybe we'll be in a place where you pay for your eggs every day over the Lightning Network, but that transaction definitely shouldn't be on chain anymore, or over some other side chain or with eCash or something like this. The possibilities are endless. But yeah, I mean, I think the thing is, I'm definitely not one to say that you need to hodl your entire stack forever. And I know that might be heretical, but the thing is, you do need to exchange your Bitcoin for goods and services. And even if you have to exchange your Bitcoin for fiat and then pay for the goods and services, I still see it as you're spending your Bitcoin, right? There are a bunch of these services now popping up that let you put Bitcoin onto a credit card and just use that credit card wherever you want. I mean, hey, to me, that's spending Bitcoin. I look at it as if I spent Bitcoin on something, if I were to use something like that, you know? So it's all just great. And if you use Bitcoin to improve your life or just to pay for your day-to-day expenses because you live on a Bitcoin standard, well, yeah, that's fine. Everyone is going to have to do that. And, you know, you have your Michael Saylors of the world who can afford to HODL because they have a million Bitcoin or whatever it is. But Saylor still needs to pay for his goods and services with something. So he's not HODLing absolutely everything.
No, I mean, there's a lot that goes into this. Like since we live in the transitory phase between fiat and Bitcoin, like those cards that you mentioned, I see that as using Bitcoin once when you top up the card and then you do the other smaller payments with that card. And even the top up can be over the Lightning Network. So it's not really an on-chain transaction until it is, right? And there is a lot to this. Like another thing, like I understand perfectly why you would want to sell your fiat before you sell your Bitcoin. It's Gresham's law. Like you want to use up the crappy money and you want to keep the good money. But one thing you should keep in mind is that we Bitcoiners are the Bitcoins. So if we want Bitcoin to succeed, we do so by helping other Bitcoiners. So if we pay our fellow Bitcoiners in Bitcoin, then they're better off and therefore we are better off. We're incentivized to do this in this way. So that should be enough for you to pay people in Bitcoin, especially Bitcoiners. Like if you know the guy and if you know that this is a proper Bitcoiner and not just someone trying to, you know, get the Bitcoin as quickly as convert the Bitcoin into fiat as quickly as possible and they end up on an exchange somewhere. I mean, I'd personally rather try to help actual Bitcoiners with their individual projects than see them end up on an exchange somewhere.
I totally agree. I think we should round out this chapter and this discussion about Bitcoin and the properties of money. A good medium of exchange needs to be able to store value. The better it stores value, however, the less likely people are to exchange it for something that isn't likely to store value as efficiently. Bitcoin's value has such a large potential upside that people refuse to exchange it for frivolous things such as coffee or mass-produced cars. Contrary to what one might think, this doesn't make it a bad medium of exchange. Quite the opposite. How often a medium of exchange is used is not the correct metric to look at when trying to measure its usefulness as such. This misses the point. What should be measured is said medium's ability to buy you as much or more than what you bought it for. Bitcoin, because it is the only tool that cannot be diluted with new supply, is the closest thing possible to a guarantee of its long-term store of value. Fiat money, inflation, and the ideas of John Maynard Keynes have distorted our perception of what money ought to be, so much so that most of us believe that coffee buying convenience is the most important aspect of a monetary good. Looking only at merchant adoption and spread of acceptance metrics, Bitcoin still seems to be struggling quite a lot. In reality, these metrics are non sequiturs and have very little to do with the actual success or functionality of the network. The price of a Bitcoin, as shown by ticker widgets and market cap websites, represents the lowest current price that anyone is willing to accept on an exchange market. Only a few Bitcoin owners are willing to accept this price, and most of them are waiting for a better opportunity. Bitcoin is indeed a currency, but it behaves very differently than all other currencies that preceded it. The fact that people are reluctant to use Bitcoin for everything but a few very important transactions is a clue to Bitcoin's monetary superiority rather than a sign of anything else. So forget about coffee, forget about whether your local franchise burger joint accepts Bitcoin or not, and start focusing on what you can use this tool for. Incidentally, since the time of writing, Steak Shack or Steak and Shake or something decided to accept Bitcoin. Shake and Bake. And we have our tahinis and everything. So the burger joints are actually coming.
Yeah. And once again, these two paragraphs sort of emphasized how I explain the previous point, right? It's we're looking at medium exchange through a Keynesian lens, and that gives us a distorted view of what a medium exchange ought to be. Like, fewer transactions is not necessarily a bad thing. And yeah, if I were to rewrite this, if I was to rewrite this chapter, I would probably add start accepting Bitcoin for your goods and services. Forget about coffee and about your local franchise burger joints accept Bitcoin or not, and start accepting sats. Like, that's how we get this thing running properly.
Definitely. And well, it's just great to see that the adoption continues no matter what else is going on. And it all starts in the when we all get together and make Bitcoin more visible. I think the thing that comes to mind directly about this is out of BTC hell came one of the most interesting little projects, this coin Beesh Bits thing. And this is actually a butcher who has a shop not far from where I live, who sells meat and eggs and is all about this carnivore thing. And he got him roped into drying meat with the heat from Bitcoin miners. And that was a prototype done for BTC Hell. And now it's turning into a whole other thing. Not only does his butcher shop now accept Bitcoin, but they're producing these Bitcoin beef bits and selling them at the moment all over Europe and hopefully in the future everywhere, right? And this stuff just happens because we all come together and talk about it and advocate for using Bitcoin and bringing it all together. So I mean, I just see this as we have to keep doing the thing. We have to keep doing what we're doing, advocating for this, accepting this ourselves, telling merchants that we want it accepted, and simply hodling our Bitcoin, using it as the medium of exchange over time property.
Absolutely. It's all part of the same thing. There is no, you can't single out one aspect. Like, that is why I've been talking about this medium exchange over time and space aspect, because I think the dichotomy is false. I don't think that this is two different properties. I think they're two sides of the same coin, pun intended. Medium exchange should work over space and time, and like, Bitcoin fixes that. That is the big thing that Bitcoin fixes. Gold was a good medium exchange over time. You could trade with your future self and thereby use it as a store of value. Fiat was a good medium exchange over space. You could trade with others, but don't see the cost of doing that. And the cost is that some asshole gets to print more of it, making it a bad medium exchange over time. Bitcoin does both, and it does them beautifully. So start accepting Bitcoin for your goods and services. Start accepting sats. Brush your damn teeth, like and subscribe, and watch the Bitcoin Infinity show every now and then.
Perfect. I'm getting the sense that we've wrapped up this discussion. Very good one, though, about the monetary properties of Bitcoin. We don't talk about it enough, even though it seems like we talk about it all the time.
Yeah, I mean, everything's connected to everything else in these books. And we'll get into a lot of this going into the future too. This is quite a short chapter, but looking forward to reading the next one with you, Luke.
Likewise, Knut. A couple of shorter ones coming up as well. This is the last book where the chapters are, some of them are in fact quite short. By the next book, Everything Divided by 21 Million, and then especially The Inverse of Clown World, the chapters are pretty consistently a few thousand words. And so we might even have to split the episodes up in the future as opposed to having quite short ones.
I think we do. I think for Clown World, there's two episodes per chapter. That's the way I envision it. Praxeology is different because the chapters are shorter there. But there's more of them.
Absolutely. So I think to wrap up, first of all, we'll just mention the Plan B Network. We're thrilled to be cooperating with them and everything that they're doing, their educational initiatives. They're doing some fantastic things in Lugano and around the world. And we're thrilled to be working with them. And so go to planb.network and check out all their educational resources. And maybe you want to contribute to some of them or join one of their courses. Yeah, planb.network. Any more to say about that, Knut?
No, I love this collaboration, and I'm going to El Salvador in January. Hopefully you are too, Luke, if you can find the time. And we're going to keep on doing stuff with the Plan B network. Also, I would like to thank our favorite hardware wallet manufacturer, Bitbox, that has their latest wallet is called the Nova Edition. It's got the latest security chip installed, and it's also now interconnectable with your iPhone in new and inventive ways. You know more about this than I do, Luke, but I absolutely love using the Bitbox. The interface is great. It's easy to use and yet complex enough if you want to do advanced stuff with it.
I think you hit the key points. Just go to bitbox.swiss/infinity for more information. And with that, I think this is it. This has been the Bitcoin Infinity Academy. Thank you for listening.
Bye-bye.